Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello, and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On the show this week, people of the world, spice up your life. That's right, the spice must flow. It's time to talk about Dune. And then we go over, it's time for the presses to roll, because we're also going to be reviewing The French Dispatch. I'm your host, Dallas King, and with me, as always, is the Paul Atreides to my Duncan Idaho. Hey, my boy. It's Lee Hitchison. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very much looking forward to this one. I think anyone that kind of knows us knows that you have been hyped for Dune since the moment it's been announced. And as a Wes Anderson fan myself, it's always an event and celebration for a new film of his. So it's been a long time since we had the Grand Budapest Hotel. So yeah, we've had a long wait for these movies, and I think we might have differences of opinion, which can be quite rare on this. Sometimes we dovetail quite well, but sometimes we really do split, and I think that might be the case with this Timothée Chalamet double bill.
Absolutely. I'm not sure if anyone saw him enthusiastically look like dancing or something outside the Curzon Soho. I mean, it's fair to have that reaction when basically you are in both of the biggest films at the UK box office this week. So, and actually, well, certainly with Dune around the world, it's the number one film at the moment. I know a lot of people were sceptical about that fact, with it also launching on HBO Max, with basically a campaign of people must see it on the biggest screen possible. And I was like, well, no, just get people to see it, because obviously, you know, we'll get into this, but there's a part two that we're hopefully going to get along the way. But we're going to dive into Dune first. As the Dune fanboy, I will be taking the lead on the conversation with this one. So if anyone is unfamiliar with the world of Frank Herbert's Dune, we can try and very quickly summarize. Basically, by Paul Atreides, a brilliant and gifted young man is born into a great destiny beyond his understanding, and he must travel to the most dangerous planet in the universe to ensure the future of his family and his people. As malevolent forces explode into conflict over the planet's exclusive supply of the most precious resource in existence, a commodity capable of unlocking humanity's greatest potential, only those who can conquer their fear will survive. So, Lee, do you know your Bene Gesserits from your Quizzak Haderach?
No, I don't. I've never read the Dune books. Like, it's not kind of, I like science fiction films, but I've never been into science fiction fantasy kind of novels. I find them a bit too laborious. I'm more of a non-fiction reader myself, and I've always wanted to watch the David Lynch version of Dune, but it's never been available on any kind of streaming services. It seems always one of those elusive DVDs. So I actually noticed it for 99 cents to rent last week as an iTunes movie of the week, so I've picked that up to watch. It's just a case of finding the right cold evening to watch. So my knowledge of Dune is very limited, but you know, I like Denis Villeneuve. His, you know, filmography is fantastic. I like a lot of the cast of Dune. So I didn't know much going in, but I was kind of, I like that position sometimes. It's nice to go in and be, you know, the person not necessarily hyped up, or the person that has all these expectations, or this is different from the book, or this is different from a Lynch version that I like. So I was kind of going in blind, which is often a really good way to watch a film, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm a Dune fan now. I wouldn't say like beyond like a couple of years ago, I probably wasn't. I mean, it's David Lynch's Dune certainly seemed like one of those films which I thought I had seen at some point, but it turns out I don't think I actually had until actually Denis Villeneuve was announced as making this new version. And so I went back and watched David Lynch's version for the first time, had pretty much no idea what was going on. Then for a holiday, I think about March 2019, I read the book on holiday. I think this was when Dune was originally meant to come out, maybe around about October or December. I think it was maybe taking the, it might have been taking the like the Star Wars slot after Rise of Skywalker was out or something like that. I think that was when it was meant to originally come out, but obviously, you know, it's now out a year and a half, 2 years later, but never mind. So having read the book, I had a much better understanding of what David Lynch was trying to go for. I mean, it is a very tricky property to adapt. I mean, there's a great documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune, about the filmmaker Alexander Jodorowsky, who had a failed attempt to adapt it back in the late 70s and was going to use people like H.R. Giger and stuff like that in order to create the world. I mean, if only Guillermo del Toro got a feature-length documentary every time one of his failed adaptations of a book or a property were never made it to fruition. Well, I guess, I mean, that's an alternative universe, perhaps. But David Lynch's Dune, it's a bit of a cursed film in that it came out after Star Wars, and it's clear watching David Lynch's version that's what the producers were looking for. They were looking to create another Star Wars. The problem is that the book is so dense and so rich in its characterization. I mean, this is a book, a science fiction book, which has, I think, several appendices at the back to basically explain more plot point, more character history, terms and stuff like that. So, yeah, it can be quite difficult if you're watching Dune for the first time without that sort of knowledge. I think my biggest... I've rewatched the David Lynch version recently when it actually got a week-long re-release just before Bond came out. I don't know if everyone was running scared, but I wonder how many people actually went along thinking it was going to be the Denis Villeneuve version, perhaps like a preview or something, and then got David Lynch's one. Well, who knows? But I actually admired it more second time round. I think basically because I had now read the book and I knew what was going on. But I think the biggest problem with Lynch's version, which is clearly something that Denis Villeneuve's version does not have, is that even at 2 hours and 17 minutes, it feels incredibly rushed, particularly in the second half. And of course, we'll get onto the fact that there's going to be part one and part two, even though if you go and see the film initially, you might not be aware of that because the title card on the BBFC certificate still says Dune, even though the title card on the film says Dune Part 1. But hey. So, I mean, without that sort of nod and stuff like that, I mean, what were your first impressions having exited the world of Arrakis?
I found it very frustrating. I think the difficulty I had with Dune was there was obviously a bit of hype going in. I know people had seen it early. I liked his previous films, but there was just something I couldn't shake watching the trailers. I was like, oh, I'm just not feeling this. And as I kind of watched this movie, you know, it's quite a significant runtime. I have no problems with letting films breathe, but I just found everything quite, the characterization very thin. The one thing I mentioned earlier, I'm not the biggest fan of like fantasy or sometimes science fiction books because I think they can almost end up being like sort of appendices and like dictionaries and encyclopedias as opposed to films or stories or books or adventures people can kind of go on, or drama where it can be like such and such does this and then there's kind of, you have to have a whole section dedicated to that. And I just find that very difficult to kind of go along with, where I was like, I just want to get to some sort of drama and interest. And, you know, I'm not the biggest Timothée Chalamet fan. I think he's put in some fine performances, but this, maybe if I'm being generous, was a good performance. He's a very vacant young person that can be easily molded in this film, which is good. So I don't know if that's necessarily his performance or that he's just really well cast to his, you know, they're taking advantage of his weaknesses. But I just found it really uninspired. And I know some of the comparisons that the film has been made to, and I know they're a bit lazy, but I think of something like Lord of the Rings, for example. You know, the first two parts of those movies, you know, the similar run times, but it felt like you went on a journey with these characters and that it was sort of semi self-contained, where you went, oh, that was a good first part, you know, our heroes have gone on a journey and I cannot wait for part two. They always end on some sort of, you know, exciting climax that is still somewhat personal as well to kind of our hero's journey, and that's good. But I never got that impression with Dune. It just felt like it sort of ambled on and on and on and on. And just when it reached the kind of climax, I thought, oh, is that it? Like this sort of bit of a sword fight. There wasn't much heart to it or interest. And I never felt much in the way of tension at all through the film, apart from maybe one brief section. And then with Mad Max as well, like, Denis Villeneuve is a fantastic filmmaker. He does so many amazing things, but I didn't find this film very visually appealing. Like, it's in the desert a lot, which is quite bland, you know, as an environment, but you think of something like Mad Max Fury Road, which made such great use of that kind of environment and the way it was filmed, whereas this, it was just like more time in the desert, and it just, I really didn't find it to be much of a spectacle at all, and it just felt the whole film was really flat.
Are you saying that you hate sand and you find it coarse, irritating, and it gets everywhere?
Unless it's lit by Roger Deakins or someone like that. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, what was it in the Nerd Party chat or something? Was it Tristan put up a thing about how Villeneuve has basically said, you know, the first part is basically world building and then he's taking the training wheels off and we're going to get straight into the action in the second part. So I think that was him trying to convince you, Lee, to give part two a proper go next time round. But I mean, part one is essentially, yeah, sort of world building and introducing all the characters and stuff. I see what you say about Chalamet's performance, and I think part of that is intentional, knowing where that character is going to go in the second film. I think probably part of it is deliberate. My wife, when we watched the trailer in front of French Dispatch at the Belmont the other day, she went, "Is this a Star Wars? It looks very much like Star Wars." And I mean, yeah, it's an easy one to compare to. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, this one was pretty much filmed on locations everywhere, so I mean, it has a much more lived in real look as opposed to just all being green screen, blue screen, etc., etc. You've got a bit of swagger coming in with Jason Momoa's Duncan Idaho, who I guess be kind of like a Han Solo type. Well, I mean, obviously you've got Oscar Isaacs in both of them, but I think he looks like he's enjoying himself more in this one. At least he doesn't have anything as bland to say as somehow Palpatine has returned. So, I mean, this film definitely goes the other way and potentially over-explaining a lot of things. But I mean, it has to be done. But at least it doesn't do it in the Lynch version, which was incessant voiceover to try and get everyone up to speed as to who everyone was and what everyone was going on. So, but I mean, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I've loved Villeneuve's films, and everything from Prisoners, Enemy, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, all 5 stars for me. I was going back and forth on this when I was reviewing it, in that I am aware that it is not a complete film, so it was borderline between a 4 and a 5, but then on a second watch, I was like, yeah, no, it is a 5. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, Blade Runner 2049 for me showed that he's very comfortable in building worlds and giving us that sort of feel where everything feels real and sort of textured and stuff like that. And, you know, I was quite happy to spend nearly 3 hours in Blade Runner 2049. I think this was just about right where it's going. I think it ended on the perfect moment. I think because any sort of later then it would be feel very sort of jarring. And then I mean, at least it didn't have, and at one point I was wondering if you know, maybe at one point Paul was going to get knocked out and then get revived and have that sort of close in of somebody's eyes opening and then cutting to black before the second one, you know, to reveal he had blue eyes or something. You know, that was a potential worry of mine, because I know it's happened in the likes of, was it one of the Hunger Games or Passengers, and one of the Twilight films, I think Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 1, I think it ended on that particular shot. It's a bit cliche. But I thought, you know, overall, I thought it was fantastic. I thought the performances were good. I mean, a lot of people I've very briefly introduced, but you know that they're going to come back in the second half for more, such as like Dave Bautista didn't really get much to do. I'm very excited to see where Rebecca Ferguson's character goes. I think she's fantastic and everything, so I'm very excited to see this. Brolin will have a lot more to do in the second one. I mean, if there's anything where David Lynch's version is superior, it's that this film does not have a shot of Patrick Stewart, who was the Josh Brolin character in David Lynch's one, Patrick Stewart carrying a pug, screaming while running into battle. But again, then again, his battle was not accompanied by bagpipes. I mean, what did you make of the sudden introduction of our Scottish national instrument?
Yeah, bagpipes introducing sort of space Nazis, eh? The one thing I would say is that I've totally fine with bagpipes in space. I was reminded of, I'm sure some of our audience have probably listened to it, but Bear McCreary, fantastic film and TV composer, he did a fantastic score for Battlestar Galactica, where he used bagpipes for the introduction of one of for this other Battlestar ship, the Pegasus. I will send you a link later on. It's absolutely fantastic, even better than the Dune soundtrack. So when I thought of that, it wasn't like, oh, this is new or exciting. It's actually like, oh, that reminds me of a better space opera odyssey. And one thing I suppose I touched on earlier is that I just think this film is devoid of any real tension. I think there's a great moment potentially where they go around and they sort of see this digger kind of collecting spice in the desert and all that sort of stuff. And there's a system in place where if one of these, you know, worms are coming towards it, it gets basically yanked into the sky in a way. You know, interesting system, but like, that moment felt like a really good opportunity for some sort of like tension or for some investment in kind of the characters. But, you know, you think of something like Sicario, for example, which is an incredibly tense, awkward and uncomfortable movie to watch at times. And there's just nothing within Dune where there feels like there's much stakes going on at all. And there's just a little moment like that where it felt like such an easy win for something like that to get me invested as an audience member. But it completely just didn't happen.
Yeah, I think at that moment in time, it's like everyone on that spice digger is essentially an unknown character. So I guess, yeah, you don't have the emotional investment with that. I mean, you know, at this point, all the main characters are safe, you know, about sort of 10, 15 minutes later, you know, all bets are off in terms of House Atreides and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, for the bagpipes, for me, it was initially a bit jarring in the fact that Atreides, it sounded like a Greek name, but then they had, with Oscar Isaac's character and the granddad being a bullfighter or something, it felt like, well, are they Spanish or something? So, I mean, I know that, bagpipes pop up in sort of military things all the time, often used to US sort of police sort of funerals and stuff like that. Obviously, I think there was famously in Wrath of Khan, I think, was another use of the bagpipes in space as well. But it was just like an interesting one. But it did get a chuckle at the Scottish press screening where I watched it. So I guess, yeah, fairly muted, I think, is fair to say. Appreciative of the craft, but maybe not completely engaged yet. I mean, what would you be needing from part two in order to get you to back to watching it on the biggest screen possible?
I mean, I'll be there for day one of part two, and I'm hoping that they do a double feature of it, which I think is highly likely. Warner Brothers does have a track record for putting on these types of events. You know, you think of the DC movies, Dark Knight trilogy, etc. Like, that should be a guaranteed. I'm really hoping, you know, it can be just sort of a mixed first half that can be pulled up, you know, redeemed in the second half. You know, hopefully it's a bit of payoff, you know, a little less world building and a bit more focused on sort of character and tension and going ways. And obviously by then, I suppose I'll have watched the David Lynch version. My rental has another 24 days or something to go on it, so I will have watched it. And I'm not too sure where the movie's gonna go, to be honest, which is quite exciting. So obviously that will be slightly spoiled by watching the Lynch version. But, you know, I'm really open to it, and I want to like part two, and I want to reconsider part one, maybe, and a bit of a you know, a quiet first half that sort of is dragged up into the others. I mean, I'm really happy that the film was a success, and I hope it's likely to get a sequel. You know, I think it's looking pretty spot on. It's just, you know, I just wish I saw the film that so many other people have seen. It just didn't click for me the way it has for huge amounts of the audience members. So, you know, I'm glad people really got something out of it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if your appreciation increases after seeing the Lynch version.
Yes, that's very true. I might go back again
and go, oh, it's a bloody masterpiece compared to that one. But yeah, no, I mean, part two is, yes, annoyingly, we are waiting on it being greenlit. Apparently, it was down to a monetary factor, even though, you know, they chucked money at Peter Jackson, who at that point had done nothing like on the scale of Lord of the Rings. They gave him the money to make to film all three films back to back. But this one, I think it was due to the fact that Blade Runner 2049 did not do very well at the worldwide box office. I think it did better in the UK initially than in the US. It actually had a similar sort of around about sort of 5 million opening weekend. But I mean, that was a sequel to a 35-year-old film, which has, to be fair, is now considered one of the greatest science fiction films of all time, but was a box office failure when it first released. So I guess Blade Runner 2049 was following in its footsteps, but I guess Warner Brothers and that were being a little bit more cagey with the money, although it does mean that we probably will have to wait until at least 2023 before we can see part two. But I think it will be coming. I think it's at probably nearly 100 million at the box office on its opening weekend. And they did say that, you know, HBO Max figures will play a part in their decision. They won't just write that off as, you know, people aren't really watching it. They are watching it. So I think as long as people watch it in any format they can, then hopefully we will get part two. And of course, if we do get part two, then that means we will potentially get, a reimagining of one of the things which you have to look forward to when you watch the David Lynch version, is Sting in a pair of leather pants. So I guess we'll have to find out. That part has not been cast yet. So it's going to be interesting to see who's going to take the Sting role in part two when that eventually comes around. But yes, get out there, see Dune. For me, it's a 5-star masterpiece. I'm thinking it's probably around about 3. Well-made, well-crafted, but just needs a little bit more from him. You need to take some spice and watch it again, I think.
Absolutely. And plus, as a Star Trek fan and that loves Patrick Stewart, I'm very much excited to finally watch this Lynch version, and the fact that you mentioned he has a pug, that makes me even more excited.
Yeah, it's just one of the random things. You'd be going like, you're doing the Poochie thing, it's like, where's the pug? I want to know what's happening with the pug whenever the pug isn't on screen. But obviously, you know, this was out this weekend here in the UK and the US as part of a Timothée Chalamet double bill with the French Dispatch. So we're going over to our editor of the Wes Anderson Fanboy Club, Lee, who's going to lead us through the next film.
Yeah, so the French Dispatch. So the staff of a European publication decides to publish a memorial edition highlighting the 3 best stories from the last decade. An artist sentenced to life imprisonment, student riots, and a kidnapping resolved by a chef. So I, as Dallas mentioned, I'm a Wes Anderson fanboy. I have loved most of his films. I'm a bit mixed on sort of the Moonrise Kingdom. I know people love that one. I think it's okay. And the Darjeeling Limited. But otherwise, I'm a huge fan. So there was, much like Dune, the trailers just weren't kind of clicking for me. I don't know if I'm getting a bit older, a bit grayer, and a bit more moody about such things, but I was kind of like, I'm not feeling this the way I did maybe sort of the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Your tolerance of whimsy has reduced over the pandemic.
Perhaps, yeah. And when I think of myself as a Wes Anderson fan and so on, I will always be excited for his work. I mean, I didn't like The French Dispatch that much. You know, I'll dive into that shortly. But days later, I still went to the French Dispatch exhibit. I've got the art book, you know, coming on the way to continue my collection that I own of it, and I will likely buy it on Criterion, you know, to finish that collection when it kind of comes around. So, you know, I'm always one of those people, like, if I don't like something, there's still a lot for me to mine out of it. But I was still kind of looking forward to this film. It was one of the film I expected to be at the London Film Festival, and was, you know, there nice and early to see it the day after I watched the Last Night in Soho. And I think the problem I had with it, and it, you know, you're kind of right to an extent, the whimsy only goes so far. When I think of my favourite periods or favourite Wes Anderson films, I think of like Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Life Aquatic, Grand Budapest Hotel, which really kind of thread that needle of whimsy, but feel still sort of grounded in a bit of a real world. A bit less so with the Grand Budapest Hotel, but you know, those early movies, they blended things really well together, where sometimes they do tend to go off in this kind of whimsical, almost self-parody direction, etc., that, you know, people often make fun of him or love him for. But I found the problem I had with this one is, you know, you think of something like the Grand Budapest Hotel, a large cast, but it's very much focused in on a couple of characters. With this, it reminded me of, and I know this is the most stupid analogy in the world, but in primary five, we had a school trip to visit like some sort of castle, and then we'd come back and we had to do a writing story about like this castle and what, you know, we could have done anything we wanted to. So I wrote this piece about the 1800s or no, probably before then. And all of us in the class had these characters that we had written in mind where we were like, you know, my friend might have had this character called Steve, or someone might have had one called Clara, whatever. And we all started trying to include all these characters in our story where we were like, and then it cuts to this bit, and then, you know, Clara meets this character, where it just didn't make sense. It was just people being jammed into the story. I felt that with this film. You see the poster, you know, the one with the cast anyway, and it's absolutely rammed with all these people that have made appearances in Wes Anderson films, you know, some big, some small, some new faces like Timothée Chalamet, but it's so overstuffed. Like, the first story works really well when we have this, like, artist that's sentenced to life imprisonment, Benicio del Toro, Lea Seydoux, and they've got such a great chemistry, more than she had with Daniel Craig, certainly, anyway, in the previous James Bond. But the problem I had was, like, after that, the stories were just lacking in interest. This felt like a really tight story, a good Wes Anderson one, but then the Students' Riot one and this kidnapping story, I mean, I mentioned the synopsis, these are meant to be the three best stories of the last decade. Those two felt very much alike, and I just could feel myself with when I was watching the film just becoming more and more disconnected from it, and it ultimately just ended up as a really huge disappointment, and I felt disappointed myself about that. I was always looking forward to this film, and you know, it'll still be a few more years before we get another Wes Anderson film, so this is the best I'll have to do for just now. But what about yourself? What kind of Wes Anderson fan are you, and what was your reaction?
I mean, I'm a big Wes Anderson fan. I think my favourite is still Grand Budapest. That was one where we turned the foyer at the Belmont Cinema into a Grand Budapest reception room, everyone dressed up and stuff like that. I noticed that a few picture house cinemas were having a lot of fun with this, dressing up as their favourite characters and stuff like that. And I think there is something about him as a filmmaker that certainly people within the industry seem to attach to and always look forward to a new release and stuff like that. It's a chance to, I guess, release their inner whimsy and quirkiness and stuff like that, to potentially the point where it's cloying and annoying, but never mind. I'm a huge fan of his animated films as well. Fantastic Mr. Fox is one of my favourite adaptations, and I loved Isle of Dogs as well when that was at the Glasgow Film Festival a couple of years ago as well. But this one, I really enjoyed it. My wife loved it. She loved the aesthetic of it. I mean, it was easy to see in this one, but potentially more than any of his other films. Just the whole thing about his symmetrical nature in terms of film, you could just see there's always like something just, it's just picture perfect every time. My wife is very keen to, we moved into a new house about 7 months ago. So we're now thinking about, you know, it's all white walls and stuff like that. So we're deciding on, you know, some painting and sort of colour palettes, furnishing and stuff like that. She basically wants at least one room in the house to be a Wes Anderson inspired room. So I think we clearly need to pick up, is it the Accidentally Wes Anderson coffee table book, to get a bit more inspiration. So potentially it's one room for a background of any future podcast, wherever it might be, slightly Wes Anderson-y. But I liked it. I think I did have some issues with it. I almost would have potentially liked to see a collection of maybe shorter stories, give a more of a flavour of the entire magazine. Like you say, there's like the nice bit at the beginning with like the sort of cycling tour of the city with Owen Wilson's character. I also think that the first story is probably the strongest, the one with Benicio del Toro and the artwork as well. Second one is definitely the weakest story. But I did have a lot of time for the third story in particular, just for the character played by Jeffrey Wright. I think this is his first film with Wes Anderson. I think it might be. I think he's just a fantastic addition to his entourage. I could listen to him narrate the phone book, quite frankly. He's just got one of those wonderful voices that you could just listen to for hours, and I think he was a great storyteller, even if the story has probably kind of been done before and was very quirky and stuff like that. But overall, I really enjoyed it and would have loved to have gone down to the exhibit. And I believe there's a coffee shop as well has opened up in New York There's quite the black market going on in Le Songe Blanche, yellow cups and saucers on eBay at the moment anyway. So I know that you managed to get a couple of magazines, but unfortunately weren't able to snaffle away any of the crockery.
Yeah, I must admit, the temptation was incredibly high. I mean, it would have been quite easy to have done it, but I was there for like 10:30 in the morning on a Friday. It was pretty dead at that point. I'd just done the first trip round of the day, and I just knew I would have got caught and like spent my last few moments in London before returning to work arrested for stealing a cup. But if a designer hasn't put them up on Etsy yet, you know, they are ready to make an absolute killing.
Yeah, I know. It's always that pang of jealousy when you see all the London film critics getting their free parcels from Searchlight Pictures. So you know, Searchlight Pictures, if you are listening to this podcast, I know Lee wasn't as enthusiastic, but I'm certainly enthusiastic, and I'm sure Lee would change his mind if he got one of the cups and saucers. So just putting it out there.
I'll take the patisserie cakes. You just send those my way and I will be a fan. But you know,
he will amend his review five exactly times. Instant classic, you know,
that I can
the most
easily
Wes Anderson-y Wes Anderson movie ever made.
Yeah,
in a good way.
I have no morals. I am so easily bought. That's why I'm like working from a negative to build up, because like no one's going to gift me a free Dune tote bag if I say I really liked it. So, you know, there's a method to the madness.
Yeah, they need to bribe you to get you in for part two.
Exactly. Well, it feels kind of, you know, kind of suppose looking ahead to next week, it feels like we're on a run of big films at the moment. We have the new Edgar Wright movie kind of coming next week. What, you know, I suppose just setting us up ahead of that, I've seen it already at the London Film Festival, but you know, we're both big Edgar Wright fans. We were lucky enough to interview him a couple months ago. What's your kind of expectation levels and hype for the new Wes Anderson movie coming on Friday, The Last Night in Soho?
It's, I mean, personally, I always look forward to a new Edgar Wright movie. Expectations are tempered and muted slightly, given the reviews that have come out since Venice and London. I think it's certainly his most divisive and mixed response to a film coming out. I think, as you said, you were like, oh, Empire Magazine will still give it five stars. But there is a new editor now. Nick DeSemelin's taken over following Terry White. Terry White finished on Edgar Wright Celebration episode, and then in the next issue he's given Last Night in Soho, apparently he's got, not him personally, but the person who's reviewed it has given it four stars. And then also Eternals has got three stars. So no major property is safe anymore. It's a new regime at Empire Magazine. So, but no, I like the look of it, the Giallo-inspired stuff. There's some interesting takes on Twitter about what it is about. I've managed to stay, I think, free of spoilers at the moment. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. But there's some cracking films coming up. I know the week after that we'll be doing another eclectic double bill of Eternals, and then Kristen Stewart is Princess Diana and Spencer, which, you know, spoiler, I loved. But so.
Yeah, I also loved it as well. So it's going to be an interesting kind of couple of weeks ahead. It feels like, you know, there's week after week now. There's been some weeks where we're like, what are we going to talk about this week? Where it feels like the cinema schedules are dictating that. And that's a good place to be, considering a year ago the cinemas went dark. So, you know, maybe films that I mixed on or anything like that. But it's so good to see box office numbers again and people going to the cinema to enjoy, you know, a big screen movie like Dune or something a bit indie like The French Dispatch. So the good times are ahead, and we'll be back next week to discuss The Last Night in Soho.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.